this week on The Inside Flap.
You know, like when you're playing chess against somebody, and if you're good, you can see like five or six moves ahead. You can anticipate what you would do, what they would do, what you would do, what they would do. I can never do that. I can see like 1.5 moves ahead. And then I'm like, I don't know. I can't even hold straight in my head. So I just have to make the move. And that's why I always lose, right? Like,
and first of all, my heart rate starts going a little faster. Like, why is our building engineer in here? He takes a look around. He looks at me, and with the deadpan look, he says, "What the hell are you doing?"
Oh no.
Yes, no really? Lie.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Abbreviated inside chat version for you today. My name is Dave Medicus. Welcome to the show. Seated across the table to my right, that's Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. We are recording just an inside chat for you this week. As Andrew likes to say, we're just very busy. We're very, very...
Dave is busy.
Dave is busy.
Is he really that busy?
We have a great guest for you this week, Jason Rakulik.
Absolutely. Yeah. He has a new book called The Last One at the Wedding.
Yes.
His second book, Hidden Pictures, was one that Sylvia raved about. And so then Dave and I both read Hidden Pictures and loved it, as have thousands and thousands
as many people have,
of other
folks. But what a rare occurrence.
But it's cool. We
for
think it's kind of cool when we all
enjoy the same. It doesn't happen a lot. It doesn't happen
a lot. We all
a
enjoy
lot.
Thrillers, but yeah. You know, Sylvia's taste since she is 18 is
That's
more,
right.
You know, it's different than the thriller that a middle-aged person might
yeah.
enjoy.
And Jason's latest, The Last One at the Wedding, is really good, and we'll have more about that and our chat with him in just a bit. But first, we are gearing up for our Sweeney Todd production at the end of October, and never has there been as complex a set.
Really?
In all my four years, that even the big
even
tree,
Red Ink,
there's nothing been as complex as what we're doing right now with a two-story rotating set with the spindle on it. We got the scrim that we had. We tore down the scrim. We put drywall up. We built platforming out from that, little platforms to connect to the rotating set. There's and not only that, but we had to build. Because, listen, Deb, you know, the other theater teacher at East, Deb.
You want, you know, all the only thing that is going through my mind right now
yeah.
are all the unfinished projects that we have at home. If I'm being real.
Yeah.
Like, I'm literally thinking about all of them.
That's a good
as
point.
You're telling yeah. me. It's fine, though. It's your job.
Well, I don't get paid for those
you
unfinished
projects. You definitely don't get paid.
Projects, yeah.
You do not get paid.
No. And I don't get paid
it's
a
job.
Lot.
It's fine.
But it is part of my job, and I do get paid.
Human nature to not...
here's your fun fact.
Okay, yes, I'm ready.
The stage director, the technical theater director, and also musical director... or theater director, whatever, the stipend that is offered by Denver Public Schools per year for
your job,
for my job, also for Deb's job,
okay.
is equivalent. It's the max you can get as a stipend
okay.
for extracurricular activities.
Okay.
It's equivalent to what a
$200?
Football... No, to what a football coach gets.
At a high school.
Yeah. A high school football coach.
Okay.
Which I think is great that, you know, there's one way that we, you know, we talk a lot of slander about.
I wasn't
Denver
sure
public
where you
schools.
Were going with that.
I see. We don't get paid a lot.
So you think that's
extra,
a good thing.
But we're capped. Like our cap is the highest
I
level.
Got you.
Musical director and football coach
okay.
are both at the top.
I got it.
Yeah.
I
so
got
that's
it.
That's my point.
Okay.
But anyway, every year, you know, the first year I got this job at East.
Not enough.
We built that two-story tree at right in the middle of the auditorium. And Deb told me, well, listen, usually our fall productions are small, intimate affairs in the black box. There's not a lot of, listen, usually you will not have to do, and she was, you know, blaming all this on COVID at the time.
Oh.
You won't have to do this kind of building usually. And what, every year it gets bigger and bigger. Now we're doing it on the stage, not in the black box. We've given up on that pretext. It's on the stage. And not only have we built this two-story rotating set, but we've also had to build stadium-level seating for the audience
when we've got
to sit in.
A theater filled with chairs.
Filled with them!
Yeah.
Filled with them.
Yeah.
So
also, I like the black box. Those chairs are very comfortable.
They're very, well, we're using those chairs.
Oh, good.
But they're big chairs, so we can only get
they
so
are.
Many.
That's why I like them.
Yeah. We can only get so many seats in, so now
we've
going
crammed in like three for two chairs.
Yeah, we do that. We always go in, it's like, all right, everybody cram in, get to know your neighbor.
Yeah.
And then I always like to say, yep, cram it in. COVID doesn't exist. Cram it in. That always gets like one guy laughs really loud and everybody else gives me a look like, what? Is this guy joking? We don't know. So we're building all that. Did have a little casualty today. So last year, you know, we had a little issues with some very sharp knives, and we were.
Can I ask you a question? Is casual? Yeah. I always thought casualty meant death.
Oh, no death! There was no death involved.
I know there
today.
Wasn't a death.
But yeah,
I don't
you're right.
know. Can you use casualty as to
no,
someone?
No, yeah, as a wounded person, yeah. A casualty. Right?
I don't know.
I don't want to be it casual about it or blasé about it, but Casualties of War,
a
great
person
movie.
Killed or injured in a war
okay, so
or
there
accident.
You go. Or accident? Because this is not war we're waiting in the auditorium.
In a
of
war
WWE's.
Or accident, yeah. So okay. You used it correctly.
All right, great. So here's what happened.
There's also a 1986 drama by the name of Casualty.
Oh. So Zoe, shout out to Zoe, who is just an unbelievable carpenter. Like we were trying to build,
great.
We had to build this slide for dead bodies to fall. So we're doing Sweeney Todd, right? So Sweeney.
Important to know.
Yeah, in the play, he slices their necks. They go flying down.
Oh, which is why you needed the two stories.
The trap door, and they go out the slide and they pop out the other end. So we had to build this slide. And I was getting so frustrated with this. I walked away, and Zoe said, well, what do you need me to do? I said, take over this slide. Just take over this. Turn around like 10 minutes later. She's got it all mapped out. She's got the angled cuts
great.
Marked correctly and done everything. She's like a master carpenter.
That's
it's
great.
Unbelievable.
That's great.
And she's the best on aux. So she's got the best
good.
Taste in music.
Okay.
So shout out to Zoe. But she was working today. She made a cut, and I guess...
Oh,
The wood backed
Zoe
up on
injured?
Her
your
on,
master
on something.
Carpenter?
Yes. She jammed her finger a little bit, just a little bit, and there was a tiny cut in her hand. Well, and then the next day I turn around and Zoe's gone. I'm like, what's going on here? Where's Zoe? Well, she signed out and left. She's got some kind of blood phobia. She got a tiny little cut in her finger. And she can't handle it.
Yeah.
So she had to leave. Mm. So I was in a bit of a state of outrage that Zoe's gone.
Those phobias,
we got well, we yeah. do have a lot of good kids working there. Simone was on top of stuff until she also broke what she built when she slid down the.
Oh, she slid down the slide.
Slid down the slide there. Yeah, so
that's
we're
too
having.
Bad.
We're really trying to figure out how this slide situation is going
can
without kids hitting their head because it's
slide?
Like they're on the top floor of what? No, because that's just going to shoot them out even faster. Like right now, it's just plywood. So I got up there to test it out. I'm wearing my gym shorts.
Oh,
yeah, that's why I'm not sitting very comfortably. So these
did you get
shorts,
some splinters?
Yeah, they rode up on me, and I got.
Oh,
there was some
okay.
some rash issues going on.
So no kid slide would work.
No, it's going to put them down even faster. We got to try to figure out how to slow them down as they're going down.
Slow the bodies down.
You know, so we're going to try to put some kind of like monkey bar situation they can
that
grab
they
on
grab
as they're going
the
down.
The dead body
so they
could
don't.
Grab.
Okay. Yeah, but they still have to look like a dead body. But there's a portion of it when they're inside the structure where they won't be seen.
Okay.
So they're seen up top. He slits their throat. the chair.
This is such a violent show.
The chair dropped. It's like a barber's chair that collapses that we borrowed from CU, and then the bodies drop through the structure.
You can always add little speed flap. Bumps. That's what speed bumps are for.
Well, that's just going to, that's true. But then their butts are going to hurt from hitting the speed bumps.
Could you do like quarter round or something? Do you know what I mean?
We're going to start out with building some monkey bars and see what that goes. Yeah, a little mini quarter round or half round.
Half rounds?
Half
you
rounds.
Need a half round.
That's what we need. Half rounds. So,
little half rounds.
As they go down. That is not a bad idea.
Thank you.
So we lost. Yeah.
Like, you can also add, I've done this with climbing walls. You can paint it, and when the paint, you add some sand to your paint. So there's some friction applied to the material.
That's not a bad idea.
Another
but
idea.
If you saw how steep this is, like I was thinking when she first described it to me, I was like, okay, we'll put this is a 12-foot by 8-foot wide thing. I said, we'll take it on one side of the 12-foot thing,
slowing them down,
and we'll go down the length of the platform. No, well that's not going to work. So, you know, now it's very steep and no amount of sandpaper is going to slow you down.
The half rounds might work.
Yeah, it might leave a few bruises on the butt, but I don't know. That's not a bad idea. Yeah, they could grab onto it with their feet as they go down. That's not a bad idea. We'll look into that.
I don't know if that would work or not. Yeah.
We'll look at it. Anyway, so we got this huge mess going on stage, and I'm there early this morning doing a few... a few little odds and ends before the kids come in, and our building engineer walks into the auditorium like 7:30 this morning.
Okay.
And I turn around and I see Raymond. The last time we had a building engineer snoop around our sets,
I remember this,
was 4 years ago for Midsummer Night's Dream. And before you know it, we had to pay a firefighter $80 an hour
to sleep during Midsummer Night's Dream.
To go as to I sleep recall. For the 2.5 hours during Midsummer Night's Dream as he's sitting
as
with
recall.
The audience. Yeah. $80 an hour. That was the last time we had our building engineer snoop around or sniff around the set. So I'm there, you know, putting stuff together. We got the drywall there. We got this huge wooden structure. We got all this stadium-style seating that we just set up after the choir finished their production. So we've got all this stadium-style seating on the risers that we've built that are like in the pit area of the orchestra, which is now facing the stage. He comes in, and he looks around. And first of all, my heart rate starts going a little faster. Like, why is our building engineer in here? He takes a look around. He looks at me, and with a deadpan look, he says, "What the hell are you doing?"
Oh, no.
Yes, no really? Lie. What the hell are you doing?
Age and celebrity most resembles.
Raymond, he's in his mid-50s, as am I. He probably, you know, maybe a little beefier Edward James Olmos, maybe.
Oh, okay, got it.
What?
intimidating.
Yes, very intimidating. but a really nice guy.
That statement does not sound nice to me.
No, it doesn't, which threw me back because he's really a funny guy. What the hell are you doing? And I looked at him. I said, and then he goes, because he's looking at the risers, you know, that he said, the stage is supposed to face that way. And he points towards the audience. So he thought that was all part of the set.
Oh.
So he's basically making a joke is what he's doing.
But he also knew he'd throw you off by saying that.
He definitely did.
Yeah,
he definitely did.
He knew.
And I said, yeah. What are you going to do? I said, we got the other, you know, I said, Deb's in here. She basically wears the pants. Well, I didn't come.
Did you say she wears the pants?
What did I say? How did I put it? I said, She is in charge. She's the one who tells me what to do, and I just do it.
Oh.
And he said, he goes, I wear the pants in my family, too. Just my wife tells me which pants to wear.
That's
or something
cute.
Like
That's
that.
Cute.
And I
That's
said,
cute.
Ah, yeah. So anyway, but that's what we got going on. Hey, check out Sweeney Todd. Come out to Denver East High School.
Oh, yeah. And October 24th
check it out.
To what, November 2nd?
Yes, basically. We have six shows.
Last show will be tough to get your hands on, right? Because it's usually seniors.
Well, yeah. And then I guess we're going to just throw extra people up on the balcony. So.
Are you really?
Yeah. Yeah, they can watch it up from there.
Huh. Mm-hmm. I might enjoy being up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Check it out. Anyway, we have a great guest for you. We're joined by Jason Rakulik. Laura, tell us a little bit more about the last one of the wedding.
So this is the latest story from Jason, and we have a middle-aged dad.
Sounds familiar.
Does sound familiar. And he gets a call from his estranged only child, his daughter, saying, "Dad, I'm getting married, and I want you at the wedding." Mm-hmm. His heart is warmed. He doesn't really think twice about that, of course. Maggie is getting married at her fiancé's family's place in New Hampshire. The wedding is soonish, and Frank starts to get excited.
Yes.
However, her fiancé is the son of a tech billionaire. Elon Musk, Bill Gates, those two men come to mind.
Yeah, and our hero is a UPS driver.
He is a UPS driver.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes.
So I was always picturing like Kevin James
worker.
with the shorts.
Absolutely. You know,
UPS guys, they never wear long pants.
Yes, no. So,
which I respect.
Very different from, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
From your tech billionaires. And Maggie also happens to work at this company. So the family's place isn't just like, oh, we have a few acres in New Hampshire. No, this is an enormous private camp with security, with homes spread out on groomed trails around a lake.
That's right, yeah.
Tasteful lighting, mm-hmm. tasteful bedding. The homes are stocked with games and puzzles. And like it made me be like, oh, man,
oh I was
I wanna,
like, yeah, I want
to Airbnb
one of
these.
This is where I want to go, for sure.
So the fiance, shocker, might surprise you, the son of a tech billionaire, is a little cold.
What? You don't say.
And Frank doesn't get a good feeling about him.
No.
Frank soon learns
that
the fiance's previous girlfriend disappeared under strange circumstance.
Yes, indeed.
So this billionaire tech family, again, dun, 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 they're weird. That may surprise you. And there is something strange going on. So there's humor in this story with Frank's sister who
there
comes along
humor,
to the wedding. Mm-hmm. She has a foster child that's in tow.
Oh, I love the foster kid.
A lot of funny scenes with the foster child and Frank.
At this fancy wedding.
At a very fancy wedding. I really enjoyed Frank.
I absolutely love
the setting. I thought the setting was fantastic. And this book goes to what I always say, you never trust a billionaire.
Never. You heard it here first. Who did you hear it from? That's right. Thank you, Laura.
Anytime.
Even
my beloved Taylor Swift.
That's right.
She is a billionaire. Nope. Can't trust her anymore.
Nope. Can't do it. Can't do it, guys. Cannot do it. Anyway, we had a great chat with Jason. Jason is such a nice guy. A great writer. You know, great writers should not be that nice.
They
we say it all the time,
they
but
always
they
are.
Always are. They always are. Anyway, so talking about his book, The Last One at the Wedding, this is Jason Rakulik.
I mean, you just can't exist. You can't like walk down the street without someone commenting right now. It's about the Phillies and actually the Eagles is starting up too. So,
oh, I bet.
Yeah, it was a big game. My team, as you can see, I'm repping the Falcons, actually beat your Eagles last night. So I apologize for that. But anyway, Jason, thanks. Thanks for being here. We absolutely loved your latest novel, The Last One at the Wedding, A Tale of Spiders, Microdosing, and Family Feud. Goodness gracious, Jason, what was it that inspired you to write this book?
Oh, boy. You know, I should have mentioned up front, this is only the second interview I've had about this book. So my answers are not quite...
They're not pat and rehearsed?
I don't have them ready to fire off just yet.
That's
I mean, it came from a lot of different places. I'll say one was the fact that I do read a lot of thrillers. My last book was a thriller. And, you know, the kinds of thrillers I write tend to fall into... You know, my editor likes to call them crime novels, but you know, technically they're what are known as like domestic suspense novels because they're about families. They, you know, No one's globetrotting, you know, around the world to find, like, you know, the microchip that's going to prevent nuclear war or whatever, you know. They're domestic suspense novels about domestic issues. And I just written, my previous book was a novel called Hidden Pictures.
Loved it. Absolutely loved it.
So good.
Our daughter read it first and turned us on to it, our teenager. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, see, you know, that book's about a young woman, and a lot of these novels tend to be about young women. And, you know, at some point I was like, well, I mean, and I know writers who work in this space, and all of their books are about, like, you know, 20
something. All about women, you know. Agreed.
And I was just thinking, well, I just did a book about a woman. I got to do something different. And, you know, one thing that I think is really funny about the domestic suspense category is that dads, when they feature in these stories, they are either, you know, villains, like murderous villains, you know, they're going to kill the family.
Right.
Or they have a second family somewhere else. You know, they always have, like, dark secrets, or they're well-meaning, but just completely oblivious, you know? And so I started to think, well, you know, maybe there's an opportunity there to do something different and bring a unique kind of character and a different kind of voice to these stories. And I thought, well, if I can do that, you know, all of the tropes of these stories will seem fresh because you're seeing them through a different kind of point of view. And so that sort of steered me to the voice of this UPS driver who, you know, I really enjoyed, like, writing in his voice and, like, trying to make it as colorful and colloquial as, like, possible. And so, you know, that was one way into it, you know.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I just love this character. And I mean, you set the tone for us, for him, when we first met him, because he's literally tripping over a partially stained and sanded lumber from an unfinished project that's been lying around. I'm definitely that guy. So I can feel Frank in my soul.
Yeah.
A great way to introduce a character. Are you like Frank? I know it's a hack thing to ask an author how much they are like their characters, but, you know,
something in some ways, yes. And in some ways, no, I've never made a coffee table. my brother has, my brother's a great carpenter. My dad is a construction worker.
Okay.
But I don't have those skills for myself. But there's certainly other aspects of his personality that, you know,
are similar.
Like, all over the place. Yeah.
I love that he's a driver for UPS. So Frank's a member of the Circle of Honor, which I guess I'd never heard of this. If you go 25 years without an accident, you get this.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's a very, very small group. How hard it would be to drive 25 years all day, every day, in this massive truck. And, you know, the accident doesn't even have to be your fault. You
know? I know. That's what I was thinking. Back into you.
So I think it's only something like less than 5%, you know, but there are enough UPS drivers that there's still a couple hundred people who are in this elite group. And you know, it's funny, I got really interested in UPS during the pandemic when we were all getting things delivered to our houses. And I just happened to, like, become friendly with my UPS driver.
Yes.
And so his name is Ian. He was a terrific resource for me. You know, he, like, answered every ridiculous question. I mean, particularly in the last section, I don't want to spoil anything for readers, but something happens.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, what would that mean for you? You know?
Wow. That's interesting.
That's funny. UPS drivers are always chatty. You know, I worked in a lot of different places where stuff is, they're always, they just seem so friendly and nice, but they're always in a rush. Like, we had our guy, his name was Harry. We called him Heart Attack Harry because he was, he would start chatting and he'd be like, I gotta go.
Well, and, you know, like, in a way, like, they're a terrific protagonist for a thriller because like, once you learn about their job, it requires, like, so many different skills, people skills, physical strength. The logistics of planning their route is insane because they can't follow that computer.
Did they plan their own route? I didn't know that.
Well, they have a prescribed route that their computer, I forget what it's called, they have this device.
Program.
In practice, at least in Philadelphia where I live, you know, any given day, there's water main repairs. There's guys on my street right now tearing up the street. So it's like, okay, you know, the computer doesn't know that, you know? And so they, but they know it because they know the geography of their routes, and or they just have to figure it out.
Huh. I used to be fascinated by them because they always drive with their door open. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed so reckless, which is silly. But I remember as a teenager just thinking, wow, I don't think I could do that.
Yeah. Well, they're belted in. So
I know.
So, we got the UPS driver. Now we also learn a little bit about his daughter, Maggie, based on the posters on her wall from her childhood bedroom. She got One Direction, the Jonas Brothers, a picture of a sloth, which makes me wonder, Jason Mikulik, what posters graced the walls of your bedroom growing up?
Oh gosh. Well, I mean, I grew up, I was like a teenager. I was in high school in the late 80s. So I probably had,
absolutely,
I might've had like a Nightmare on Elm Street poster on my wall, yeah, like a Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
I might have had like a Sports Illustrated swimsuit model there on my wall. Because I still had posters like that back then.
Yeah, I remember seeing that in kids' bedrooms because we are probably all about the same age. Yeah.
Yeah. So those two I definitely remember. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, maybe Elle McPherson, I believe, was a big...
she was a big one then. Yeah, that's true.
I was a big movie guy too, so I had movie posters all the time.
Yeah.
I would just, I would buy movie posters, or I'd get them from the video store. They used to give them away,
Get
them rolled up by the door. So I would just, any movie, I just liked having the posters to look at.
It was cool to have those posters. Yeah.
I really liked when Frank goes to meet his daughter and her fiance at their apartment for the first time. And not only does he bring Milano cookies, which like, who doesn't like a Pepperidge Farm Milano cookie?
Sure.
He also brings two fire extinguishers, which to me, you just saying what he brings tells me exactly what kind of person he is, what kind of dad he is. I absolutely loved that because, of course, she's going to look at him like he's crazy, be like, thank you. But like me as a daughter of a dad who probably would do that, I loved that. I thought that was such a nice detail.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's the sort of thing that my mother probably did that more than my dad. She would just like absurd things. But now that my son just got his own apartment.
Oh, and wow.
I was like, I couldn't believe I found myself thinking it. But I was like, do you have a fire extinguisher?
I know, because you got to have one under the sink is where you usually...
And you should have one, right?
Yeah, you should have one.
And you can always use an extra, like if you do, put one in the bedroom or something like that.
Yes, that's really funny.
We never end up using them. And I always like look at them and I'm always like, I don't know how to use it, but it's there. So I guess if I need it, I'll figure it out,
Well, I won't tell the story, but I have a boring...
Oh, no. Question.
Well, I mean, we one year, I mean, maybe I have more of Frank and myself than I realized. We had a bunch of teenagers over and I'm like, guys, you should know how to use a fire extinguisher. So we just like wasted one in the backyard. I was like, everyone try it, spray something.
That is Frank.
Pull the pin. And
it's like mace or something, I think. I feel like it's like using mace. I could be wrong.
It's you just squeeze it and it comes out and it's just, I've never fired a mace canister. That is
Dave just showed our daughter who's at college for the first time how to use mace.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You got to really press down on that. quite the ever. I was in the movie theater. I just had this memory watching Naked Gun, the third one, 33 and a third. And like towards the end, this guy, I don't know if he was on drugs or what, he ran up, he grabbed the fire extinguisher off the wall, set it off inside the theater.
The whole theater,
and then it's just like filled up with smoke. We had to leave. We got our money back. But he set it right in front of in the theater there.
That's really funny.
In your book, Aiden, who's a painter, he tells Frank he gets inspiration for his paintings from people that he sees walking around the city of Boston, which makes me curious. Do you do the same thing? Are you a people watcher? Do you sit on the streets of Philadelphia? Which is a great song, by the way, Streets of Philadelphia. Bruce Springsteen. There you go.
I mean, I do that a little bit. You know, like I can definitely, if I'm in what might be a boring situation to a lot of people, what, you know, you see people looking at their phones, you know, all the time. And like, I love to just like look around and try to actually concentrate on it. Cause you know, if you just pay a little bit of attention, you just start to see things. It's easy to just like let the world sort of just let it go by you, but you just have, like, if you just look a little bit, you know?
Yeah, it's entertaining also if you look a little bit. Yeah.
And that's probably why I was also, I love going to weddings. So like writing this book is, the book takes place completely, almost entirely at a wedding. You know, when you go to a wedding as a writer, it's sort of great because you know the story before you get there. You know what's going to happen, but you don't know how it's going to happen. And so, you know, if you and also the other great thing is you're seeing like people, you're seeing like the heights of human emotions. Like this is the one of the most important days of like so many people up there, you know, in this performance. And so, you know, I've always just enjoyed that. As somebody who like tries to like study people and study like relationships and so, you know, it's just a really great setting for a thriller, you know? And there obviously are a lot of them, you may not be paying as much attention as I am right now, but I think there are like four or five like wedding themed thrillers that came out this past year.
Oh, really?
But they're all about, I mean, I think they're all very different books. Like, I don't really sweat it because I'm like, well, nobody's really written the story I've written. They're, you know, they're about people who are like wedding guests, you know, and I'm like, well, all right, you're already like 10 steps removed from the action when you're a guest, you know. You can be like an amateur sleuth who's like finding why there's a dead body in the swimming pool, but you're not, you know, right up in there the way, my character is, because he's the father of the bride.
That's true. I got a big laugh when Frank and Tammy, Frank's sister is named Tammy, they're pulling into this camp for the first time, and then he realizes that he's wearing the same outfit as the groundskeepers. That was genius. I paused and laughed because that really got me, and I think it was one of his expression was like, oh, for crying out loud. Which is very Frank.
Yeah, he feels very uncomfortable and very much out of his element, because although, I mean, he does pretty well for himself. He's a teamster, you know, so I think he actually makes a really good living.
Yeah.
And he's proud of everything he has, and he should be. It's the kind of background I grew up in. But he still has like a bit of whiplash being around people who are just, you know, not just well off, but like really well off, you know, like I'm private plane people, you know. Yes, it's a weird thing.
It is. And they are not like us. Yeah. I have a question getting back to that. So you said your father was in construction. How did he feel about having a writer son?
He was totally on board. He loved it. My dad loved, well, he read a lot of books, but he also loved movies. He probably loved movies more. And he loves stories with like crazy twists. Like I have this very vivid memory. It's one of my favorite memories of we were watching. There's a movie. It was a play. There's a great play by Ira Levin called Death Trap.
Oh, and I like Ira Levin.
Remember the movie? It was like with Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve. And there's a great twist like an hour into Death Trap. And it was just, I remember like when it happened, we were watching the movie at home on HBO and like he fell off the couch. Like he was just like, oh my God, you know? And we both like were just like blown away by this reveal. And you know, some part of me wonders if like I've just been like chasing that, like, you know, when I write these books, if I'm trying to like sort of like, you know, it's just one of my favorite things in fiction. Like when you do it right.
Yeah.
The satisfaction of like a perfect,
it's surprise. What we all chase as readers too, because we want that. I'm a person who will try to figure it out. I think Dave just reads for the enjoyment of reading.
Try to figure it out. I don't want to get
but I always try to figure it out, and when I can't figure it out and it surprises me, it's the best. Yeah, it's absolute must. You also have a foster child named Abigail in the story, who I really loved. I thought she was funny and real and was moving with her, but also just funny. She added so much to the story. I was kind of curious, did you always have Abigail in mind when you were writing, or did you think, I need a third person with Frank and Tammy?
I have a really a frustrating process, which is that I try a lot of different things. I think, here's an analogy I thought of just the other day. I don't know if this totally works, but I'm a really bad chess player. You know, like when you're playing chess against somebody, and if you're good, you can see like 5 or 6 moves ahead. You can anticipate what you would do, what they would do, what you would do, what they would do. I can never do that. I can see like 1.5 moves ahead. And then I'm like, I don't know. I can't even hold it straight in my head. So I just have to make the move. And that's why I always lose, right? Aww. Like, and the same thing happens to me when I'm writing. Like if I'm trying to like outline a story and predict what would happen, eventually I just get like, it just starts to feel like so abstract and theoretical. I'm like, I guess I just have to try it. I just have to like start writing things. And when it feels wrong, I'll stop. And so to answer your question, before Abigail was a sweet 10-year-old foster child, she was like a surly 17-year-old foster child. And before that, Frank had a son who was even older. I think he was like 23, unemployed. And I did spend a lot of time thinking about, okay, who is in this car? Who's going to this wedding? Who are like the members of this family, and what do they do in the story, and like what roles do they serve? I wrote a lot of pages chasing things that didn't work, but I don't know how to do it more efficiently.
Yeah, you don't know until you get it. Do you have to run that? Like when you realize that it works, do you ever have to run that by your editor or a friend, or like, hey, could you read this? Should I cut this or change it?
No, I can feel it. I can just feel it. Like I can feel when it's wrong, and then I can feel when it works. And I just have to like try a lot of different things.
Her having lice and then having Tammy put, I had never heard of mayonnaise on lice.
No, it doesn't work.
I know. But
it's
her
an old wives' tale.
Putting like old like mayonnaise that's gone bad on top of the head was like, it was so good. It was so good.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. The book is like, there's parts of it that are really, really dark. And
there are absolutely
really, really sad. And I felt like, well, I have to have like, there has to be like levity in this book. Otherwise it'll just be like a tragedy.
Yeah.
And so that all those scenes were really fun to write where Frank, it's just, you know, you have this main character who's already uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
And he finds out that in addition, he already feels insecure about going to this wedding. But in addition, his sister is bringing her foster child, who happens to have a tiny case of head lice, just a tiny, tiny case of head lice.
What do you want when you're sitting around a large group of people? You want
Frank is so like dismissive of Abigail at times too. And like, he's had enough. And then the mention of her, like her little teeth too. She's got some like yellow pointy. It was just, it could have been really sad and moving, and it was moving, but it wasn't really sad. And I appreciated that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Thanks. I mean, it's some of my favorite parts of the story, because it's a really tough book to talk about for people who haven't read it, because
can't give away too much.
The book goes in a lot of unexpected directions, and
that's what we expect from your books, and time and time again, it's another you knocked it out of the park with this one. But I can get a comment from you on this, and there is some wisdom to be learned in this book, which is when Vicky, who is a woman that Frank, might be romantically involved in at some point, but she gives him some advice. She says that every parent is an unreliable narrator. Ability to view their kids object. That's genius.
I did self-reflection on that one. Yeah.
You're so right. We are unreliable.
Yeah. I'm glad you zeroed down that line, because when I wrote it, I wasn't thinking about it. Like Vicky was just talking and then she said it, and I was like, oh, I think I just wrote like the thesis statement for my novel. Because, you know, for people who haven't read the book, you know, Aiden, Frank's future son-in-law, his parent, he's been accused of this crime, but his parents insist that he's innocent. And because of course they do, you know, and you just see it play out time and time again. I just read a book, great nonfiction book called The Art Thief by Michael Finkel. About these 25-year-olds, boyfriend, girlfriend, they stole $2 billion worth of art.
Okay? Wow.
And instead of trying to sell it, the reason why they were so successful, they had 200 thefts from different museums, broad daylight. They just went in with a Swiss Army knife, walked out with the stuff tucked under their overcoats.
Oh.
And then they brought it home. They lived in the guy lived with his mother in her attic, and they just hung it all up in the attic. Mm-hmm. So now mom is going up there and she's like, geez, where'd you get these paintings from? Where'd you get these vases? These like, you know, priceless, bejeweled, you know, and he's like, oh, yard sale, garage sale, you know, and you know, well, what's mom going to do? You know what I mean? Like, you just want to believe it, right?
Oh, you do want to believe.
And I won't spoil the book for you. I didn't even, what I told you is just like the beginning. And then it goes in some really crazy directions. True story.
That sounds like a great book.
It's really good.
I feel like sometimes too, our daughter will tell us something and I think you're probably lying, but at the same time, maybe I don't want to know the real story.
Yeah. 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 And I've been there too with both of the kids. I was like, oh.
Yeah. So it's time now for our segment we call Quick Six. And this is six quick questions in which we find out a little more about you.
Okay.
And they are softball questions, Frank. Or sorry, I'm calling you by your character's name.
That's okay.
Jason. That's so funny.
The Inside Flip.
Mike White, the writer, director, he's really good. I mean, he's just amazing. And he's also writing a lot about, I mean, you can see it in White Lotus and a lot of his other stuff too. He's interested in the same class conflicts that pop up in Last One at the Wedding. I mean, White Lotus is all about class. Yeah. And like the upstairs downstairs thing of like the wealthy tourists and the people who work the hotels. Yeah. And you know, there's a lot of that in Last One at the Wedding. There's a lot of that in Hidden Pictures.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And he has a great movie called, what's it called?
He did School of Rock. He did School of Rock, which is a kind of different.
Yeah. It's something called like Beatrice something. And Penelope Cruz in it.
Okay.
And if you just Google Mike White and like Penelope Cruz, it'll pop right up. And that's another really good movie about wealthy people and the people who work for them. It felt like a test run for White Lotus when I saw it. I was like, oh, he hadn't fully resolved everything he wanted to write about, so he did White Lotus next.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy for sure.
Is it called The Counselor?
No, not that. It's not that. It's
That's interesting that you are interested in that too, because that was really beautiful with Frank going into his future in-law's place. And just seeing all this, and he's so out of his element. I just wanted to shake him a couple times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about this? Can you hear me all right? How am I?
I think you're back.
All right, good. I'm back. What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, it's funny, off the top of my head, I was just thinking about this book. There's a Stephen King novel called Bag of Bones, and it's set at a lake house, like a summer house in Maine. And I always loved that book. I love the setting of that book. I always thought the setting of this house on the lake was so cool. And I always did kind of, it was like the kind of world I wanted to just like live inside. And then I ended up writing this book, which is about a lake house in New Hampshire. Okay. And I'm like, well, you know, sometimes this stuff is just like...
Book had a little Stephen King feel to me. And I think it was because what you just said, it was set, you know, in that neck of the woods of the country. And then also the narrator had a little bit of a vintage Stephen King narrator feel, which I love. Yeah. Yeah,
me too. I mean, I was like, I grew up on his early popular 80s books. And, yeah. And I feel like, you know, I learned to write just by reading all of his.
Yeah.
I mean, when he does first person, it's just so good, you know.
The best. It's the best.
You can tell, like, I mean, I was not surprised at all. Like when they did the Shawshank movie, giant chunks of that movie are just Stephen King narration from the novel. It's just everything Morgan Freeman is saying. That's just like prose that he wrote. Yeah. You can just listen to it. You know, it's so good.
That gets us to the next question, which is how about a top five favorite movie besides Shawshank?
Can't say Shawshank.
I think my last, like my most recent favorite all-time A++ movie was Knives Out. I thought Knives Out was just so total good. Home run, did everything I hoped it would. It was everything I hoped it would be and more, you know, because that movie, you know, it takes all your expectations, turns them inside out. You know, you think it's going to be a whodunit and then you find out whodunit. But then it turns them inside out again at the end.
Yeah.
That was really good.
So
great Southern accent in that by.
What's Daniel his name? Craig. Daniel Craig. Yeah, he was so good in that. Yeah.
How about this? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
You're still going out a little bit, Dave. Yeah. How about one of your favorite books? Or a book that maybe comes into your mind now.
Let's see. Well, I've just talked about Bag of Bones. You know, there's I'm not going to necessarily recommend this because I think the second half of it is not so great, but I love the first half of it. And most people have never heard of this book. There's a suspense writer. He's an old-timey suspense writer named Cornell Woolrich.
Never heard of him.
He's most famous for writing a short story called It Had to Be Murder that Alfred Hitchcock made into Rear Window.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But tons and tons of his other stories and books have been adapted to film. He was a really curious, unusual guy, and he wrote tons and tons of great suspense stories. He has a great book called I Married a Dead Man that's been adapted into three different movies, I think, because the story is just so good. And he has this book that it's still in print. It's called Waltz in the Darkness. And it's about this, it's set in the 1880s. It's written in like 48, I think. But it's set in the 1880s. It's about this wealthy New Orleans, he's a coffee merchant, I think. And, you know, back then, like you'd find a spouse by like putting ads in newspapers. You know what I mean? Like before the internet, right?
That's funny.
And so he starts this correspondence with this woman and they fall in love and they agree to get married. She's going to move to New Orleans and marry him. And all this happens in like the first five pages. And so the book opens, he's getting ready to get married. And what he hasn't told her is that he's actually very, very wealthy, right? Because he doesn't want her to know that. He doesn't want her to just marry him for his money. And she sends this photo of herself to him and she looks very plain. In the language of the time. Then she shows up, she gets on the train and she's a knockout. And she's like, well, I didn't want you to know I look like this because I want you to marry me for who I really was. And he's like, well, this is great because I didn't want to tell you I'm actually really wealthy. And so it seems wonderful. But then all these red flags start to accumulate. For example, he already took her ring size before the wedding and the ring doesn't fit on her finger. Mm. And he's like, that's weird. And all these things like quickly accumulate where he's like, I'm not sure that you're the person that I was writing to.
I got a little chill. That's good.
Yeah. And it's like, he's like been like catfished, you know, before like catfishing was even like a thing. Right. And it's so like the first half of it is just like so good and so exquisite. And maybe had some small influence on my book, Last One at the Wedding, just because they're both like wedding stories.
Oh, that's interesting.
How about this? Jason, do you have a go-to karaoke song?
No, I don't like karaoke. Oh. I don't really sing in front of other people. I don't do it.
All right. That's
good. He's like, heck no. No. Last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
I just got... it is the new book by Eric Larson. He's a nonfiction writer. He's got this
Devil
book
in the White City. War.
Yeah, Devil in the White City is like his big, massive bestseller. And this new one is called, I think it's called The Demon of Unrest. And it's just about, it's about the 6 months between when Lincoln got elected and the Civil War started.
Oh.
And it's really pretty interesting. you know, some a lot of interesting parallels to like right now, you know, if you wonder, like, you know, sometimes people speculate, like, are we on the brink of civil war?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I want to write about what it really felt like to actually be on the brink of civil war.
Wow. You know?
And it's pretty interesting. I didn't realize quite how unpopular Lincoln was.
I didn't know that.
Like, there were 10 states that hated him so much, they didn't even put him on the ballot.
Wow. You know?
So you think we're divided now. It actually was.
Oh, I did not know that. Wow.
Fascinating.
So.
Sounds really fun.
Thank you so much for joining us. Loved your book so much. Both of us really loved it. Now
we
get to send it to our daughter and have her read it as well.
Yeah. So,
very rare when we find books that all three of us can enjoy.
True.
Talking to you. The last one at the wedding. Thanks so much for coming.
I want some of that wedding food, though. You made me so hungry as I was eating.
Okay, well, thank you so much. This is a lot of fun. It was great to meet you both.
Thank you. Have a great rest of your day.
All right, you too.
Bye. Bye-bye.
The Inside Club. All right, there you go. That was Jason Mikulik, and that was our show for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with a full show. Andrew Dowd and Laura just hit her elbow on the microphone.
Hit my elbow.
That was a first. You all right?
I'll be all right.
Okay.
Yep.
You know, rub a little, you know, we used to say rub a little dirt in it.
Dirt?
Can you believe it?
Yeah, it's
like
weird.
When I was a kid, that was the thing. Rub some dirt in it.
Huh.
And you'll be fine. Like when you're playing baseball, whatever, you slide.
That's if you bleed.
Rub some dirt in it.
Huh.
All right. Anyway, see you later.
Adios.
What the hell are you doing?